The film version of Ayn Rand's 1957 novel, Atlas Shrugged, is now in theaters, and a new generation of conservatives is finding her laissez-faire philosophy bracing. Rand lived in Manhattan, and many of the fictional sites in Atlas Shrugged are based on real places. NPR's Margot Adler recently got a tour.
Frederick Cookenham, a middle-aged guy, gray hair, gray beard, stands outside Grand Central Terminal during evening rush. He's holding a sign, Ayn Rand Walking Tours. He actually has 5 different Rand tours. I met him last Saturday in the pouring rain. No one showed up, but I took the tour anyway. He pointed out where Rand lived, where her publisher had an office, her favorite buildings, her favorite architect. He looks down Park Avenue.
Grand Central Terminal, that becomes the Taggart Terminal in Atlas Shrugged, which means that the building there with the green mansard roof, that is the New York Central building, so that becomes the Taggart Transcontinental Railroad building.
So we are standing in
the lobby of what is now the Helmsley Building, but this building was built in 1927 as the headquarters of the New York Central Railroad.
It's here that the heroine of Atlas Shrugged, Dagny Taggart, has her office, he says. Atlas Shrugged is really a mystery in which leading industrialists and inventors disappear in protest against what they see as a collectivist bureaucratic society. In one scene, Taggart discovers a strange cigarette with a gold dollar sign on it. No such cigarette exists in the world. Cookenham touches an old wooden newsstand counter, now a security desk in the building. It's the newsstand where she tries to find out where the cigarette's from, he says. Back in the rain, Cookenham points out a bleak little alley. It's where Taggart's ramshackle office is located when she leaves her railroad company and builds the John Galt Line. He begins to read from the novel.
The windows of the offices of the John Galt Line faced a dark alley. Looking up from her desk, Dagny could not see the sky, only the wall of a building rising past her range of vision. It was the side wall of the great skyscraper of Taggart Transcontinental. We're standing under it right now. She sat looking across at the open cavern of the express and baggage entrance of the Taggart Terminal, right over there.
The next day is unexpectedly beautiful. I go back on the tour, and there are people. Judy Chambers from Ontario, Kathy Bliss from California, and Zach Fivenson from Chicago.
I just finished reading Atlas Shrugged 6 months ago. I couldn't put it down.
I attempted it once. I found it dated and dreadful. And I totally disagree with all of her political views.
I'm a huge Ayn Rand fan, and actually I do really, you know, believe in a lot of the objectivist philosophy, you know, individualism versus collectivism.
Cookenham doesn't want to talk politics. Although he is a follower of Ayn Rand's philosophy, what he wants to emphasize for the tourists is history and literature.
They don't know that she lived in New York. They don't know that she came from Russia. They don't know that she was Jewish, and her real name was Alyssa Rosenbaum.
Walking through Grand Central, we come to the tracks. Rand took a private tour of the railroad, even drove a train for her research. Some of the tracks are abandoned in the novel, given economic collapse, and somewhere on those abandoned tracks,
in some dark place on a pile of burlap sacks, Dagny and Galt have their sex scene.
As someone who has taken commuter trains out of Grand Central time after time, I may never think of those tracks in quite the same way. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
And now let's go to a country that's finding out what comes after a revolution. Egypt is in the early stages of a presidential campaign. The candidates include Mohamed El-Baradei. For years, he was the chief nuclear watchdog at the United Nations. That work, which earned him a Nobel Peace Prize, is now the subject of his new memoir. It comes out even as he campaigns for president. In what way, Mr. El-Baradei, are you working to build support right now, political support?
Well, I'm basically focusing, Steve, right now on making sure that we have a democratic infrastructure, a proper democratic constitution, a proper parliament, democratically elected, giving time for the parties to establish themselves after the revolution, making sure that the presidential election will be again similarly democratic. But at the same time, I'm talking to people, engaging people, telling them what the future of Egypt should look like. But my main focus right now is to make sure that everything is set for a new Egypt, if you like, because I made it clear that I would only run if there is a proper democratic system in place.
So it is not definite that you will run?
For now, I am running, but I'll have to keep my options open, because if anything were to happen contrary to my conviction, then I do not want, obviously, to be part of a decor.
Did you say don't want to be part of the decor?
Yeah.
As you travel about, do you feel that Islamists are gaining more power and influence day by day?
Well, I think they are now the only organized force, so they are gaining ground, while the other parties, the parties of the young people and other who made the trigger the revolution, are just about starting their own parties. And that's also one of the reasons I believe that having the election in September is way too soon, because you would not have a level playing field at that time. The new parties are not yet fully engaged.
Now, let me ask you about this book, which I'll mention is called The Age of Deception, and it covers what I guess we can now think of as your previous life, running the International Atomic Energy Agency at a really momentous period involving Iraq, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the Iran issue. You were working on issues relating to Libya, relating to North Korea. And if I may, there seems to be a common theme of disappointment. You were disappointed in how almost all these situations turned out. What do those disappointments have in common?
All the disappointments, Steve, has in common that we never really looked at the big picture. There was always a sense of condescending on the part of the U.S. in particular, and during the Bush administration, that these countries have to buckle under pressure, where I knew that they will not buckle under pressure because it had to do with their security. There were, in many cases, particularly in Iran, the demand that Iran should be completely undressed before the U.S. sit with them around the negotiating table. So I saw lots of conflict that had to do with war and peace that could have been easily resolved.
You think that the United States could have reached an agreement with this Iranian regime? Because, as you know, there are plenty of American foreign policy specialists who are dubious that really the Iranians ever want an agreement.
Well, I disagree with that, at least based on my experience. Of course, there was a number of situations where they were bypassed by the U.S. insistent that Iran should not have one single centrifuge running. And that was obviously not realistic, Steve. However, even we were very close during the Obama administration, and Mr. Ahmadinejad personally was very much interested in having a comprehensive package with Iran. But again, unfortunately, that chance was lost because on the Iranian domestic situation, people were in a more payback mode after the election in Iran.
Let me just clarify what you're saying here, though, because you're saying that there were many missed opportunities because the Bush administration insists that Iran give up everything before talks began.
That's correct.
Then the Obama administration did talk with Iran, did seem to reach an agreement, at least with Iranian diplomats, and the Iranian government backed away from that agreement. Does that suggest that really there wasn't that much room to have a negotiation to begin with?
No, Iran was in the aftermath of the presidential election in Iran, and
their disputed election, yeah.
And then Ahmadinejad was not able to go ahead with the agreement because his detractors were after him, saying he was selling the store, blah, blah. So he couldn't go forward with it. But by that time, the Obama administration was really has its hands, you know, full with domestic issues and could not engage Iran as they were able to 6 months before.
Are you suggesting that after making an effort which didn't work out very well in the early part of his administration, President Obama more or less forgot about Iran or was distracted by other issues and wasn't able to pay full attention?
I don't think he was distracted, but I think the domestic political situation did not give him the freedom, the elbow room, to be able to negotiate with Iran.
Is the non-proliferation system that has been designed for decades to prevent more nations from getting nuclear weapons broken?
Yeah, it is broken, I think, Steve. You know, this was a system that was built in 1970. Lots of things happened in the last 40 years. Lots of countries now have the ability to develop nuclear weapons or have the know-how to develop nuclear weapons. So the weapon states need to send the message loud and clear, and not just a message, but act on it, walk the walk, that they are moving toward a world free from nuclear weapons. If you are not going to do that, in the long term, you cannot have a system of security based on nuclear haves and nuclear have-nots. The system of security based on nuclear deterrence is an absolute way to self-destruct.
Mohammed Alberadei is the author of The Age of Deception, and he is also, at least for now, a presidential candidate in Egypt. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Steve, for having me.
A violent storm system swept across the South and Midwest yesterday and into today. It spawned tornadoes in parts of Arkansas, Mississippi, and other states, killing at least a dozen people. A relentless rain followed, flooding already swollen rivers and creeks. Thousands of people have been evacuated along the Ohio, Missouri, and Mississippi rivers and their tributaries. And as NPR's David Shaper reports, the worst is yet to come.
Already one of the wetter and stormier springs in recent years, the weather in the Midwest and South Central parts of the country keeps getting worse. This latest set of storms moved into central Arkansas late yesterday afternoon, with a tornado tearing through the small town of Valonia, Arkansas.
It's pretty devastating. There are between 14 and 16 homes that have been destroyed, several others that are damaged. The winds snap the electrical poles like toothpicks.
Faulkner County spokesman Stephen Hawks says downed trees and power lines made rescues difficult. Authorities there say four people died in Valonia. In the northern part of the state, raging floodwaters swept cars and trucks off the roads, killing at least five people. Three were killed in Mississippi as well. In western Kentucky, no tornadoes, but high winds knocked down trees, including one that fell under the home of Joe Muncy in Murray, Kentucky.
Yeah, I was awakened last night about 12:15. Scared. I mean, I was scared, you know.
Now, flooding in the state is bad and getting worse.
The Ohio and Mississippi rivers are forecast to have major flooding, with the possibility of historic flooding along the rivers from the Kentucky-Tennessee line on the Mississippi through the Cairo confluences and all the way up the Ohio River to Smithland, Kentucky.
That's Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear, who declared an emergency. And there are similar declarations in parts of Indiana, Illinois, Arkansas, and in Missouri, where Governor Jay Nixon activated 200 National Guard troops to help in sandbagging and rescue operations along the flooded Black River near the Arkansas border, an area deluged by 15 inches of rain in the past few days. 1,000 residents of Poplar Bluff, Missouri, were told to evacuate yesterday when floodwaters started topping the levees there. Butler County Sheriff Mark Dobbs says one of the levees breached today, but despite repeated warnings, some residents did not evacuate and had to be rescued by boat.
Had one report from the fire chief that there was an individual even in southern Butler County stranded on top of a house. So, you know, there are some dire situations because some people chose to stay in their homes.
Now, thousands more along the river may need to be evacuated. Missouri's attorney general is going to court to try to block a plan by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to intentionally blow out an earthen levee along the Mississippi River to divert floodwaters there. He says good farmland could flood, too, and hundreds of Missouri residents could be affected. More storms are forecast for tonight, and high waters from snowmelts up north are still moving down the Ohio, Mississippi, and Missouri River valleys, leading the National Weather Service to forecast that the Mississippi won't crest south of Memphis until mid to late May. And when it does, it will likely be at its highest level since 1937. David Shaper, NPR News.
This is NPR.
Next, to matters of personal finance. And often on this program, we talk about mutual funds and insurance and stuff like that. How about saving money with coupons? From a woman who calls herself Miss Coupon Diva. How big of a diva? Joyce Howe says she has not paid for toiletries in years. And with the money she saved using coupons, she has pursued a nursing degree. Now she gives consultations and seminars to people who want to learn how to save big bucks. Joyce Howe joins us now for our Money Coach segment. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So how did you get hooked on coupons?
I had an incident where I bought a box of Pampers for my daughter, and several of them weren't usable. And I took them back to the store and asked the grocery manager, you know, I really need to be able to use the entire box. And he looked at me, and he was very condescending. He said, well, I got a dime for you. And I didn't like it. So I came home and I wrote to Procter & Gamble, because back then you didn't have the emails and 800 numbers that we have now. And a couple weeks later, I got a letter from them saying that it was something wrong with it because I had enclosed one of the diapers so they could see what I was talking about. And they gave me a coupon for a free box. Every so many months, they sent me a coupon for another free box. So I never had to buy any more diapers for my daughter. And when I had twins 10 years later, I still had coupons to buy diapers for them.
What? So those coupons had not expired?
Not back in the 70s. They had no expiration date on them.
So that was one thing. So you had your diapers taken care of. How did you decide to keep it going?
Well, I realized the money that I didn't have to use to buy diapers gave me money to buy other stuff. And I learned to utilize the coupons to stretch my budget so then I'd be able to start saving money, which enabled me to go to nursing school. And then there was an interim where I had to be laid off because my job closed and I was pregnant. And coupons literally fed my family until I found another job.
Give us an example, if you would, because I think one of the reasons that some people say they don't use coupons is that they're constantly getting coupons for things that they don't really need or want.
If you're looking through the coupons and you have products that you are consistently buy, every product now has a contact information on it. Call the company, email the company and say, I like your product. However, I never see coupons for it. And most times they'll send you coupons or tell you how to get them because they normally have emails now where they will inbox them to you.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're having a regular Money Coach segment. Today we are talking about how to save with coupons, and we are visiting with the coupon diva, Joyce House, who is telling us how to score big with those little coupons. So what about the time factor? I mean, you spend a lot of time comparing. Do I have that right? Like, you'll get circulars from more than one store and go through them.
Right. I'm a single mom who worked night shift and went to nursing school during the day. But if you need to save money, you'll figure out the time. So I probably now, because I've been doing it now for 35 years, spend tops 20 minutes a week going through the circulars because you have an eye for what you're looking for and what you have a coupon for, and you're done with it.
How much have you saved, you think, in one shopping trip? Like, what's your best score?
My best shopping trip was $300.68. And I only had to pay 52 cents.
Stop it. 52 cents?
52 cents. And the reason why I remember that one so well, it was one of the time of the year when you have to spend $300 to get your free turkey. And I still got my free turkey, only though I only spent 52 cents.
How is that possible?
Because coupons are money. So when you present them to the cashier, it's as if you're giving them your money.
And how do you get these coupons? Do you mainly go online now, or do you still use the circulars or the coupons that they give you at checkout, which sort of keeps track of what you buy? What do you primarily do now?
Still the newspaper. I'm networking with my neighbors and friends. People give me their coupons and say, you know, I'm out of blah, blah, blah. So if you see it on sale, can you pick it up for me? I did a lifestyle change back in 2002. So I try to walk, weather permitting, 5 to 7 miles a day. Literally, people buy the Sunday paper and they don't look at the coupons, and I can pick them up right out of their bins.
So how much do you think you've saved over the course of time?
Well, I can tell you in 95, I brought a van. It was $22,000 cash. And recently, my daughter needed a car to get to law school, and I paid for her car cash. New cars. I've never had a used car.
So that's where all that grocery money is going.
Yep.
Right.
It's been our cruises, all our family vacations. You know when you see at the bottom of your receipt that said you saved? I always bank that money, and that's how we lived.
And here's a sensitive question, but I do have to ask it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the food that is heavily discounted is not the food that is healthiest for you, for example. I don't know that they're often doing a lot of discounts on like fresh fruit and apples and such like that. So how's your diet?
Well, I've lost 85 pounds. Now, if I have a $300 bill and I only pay 52 cents, can I buy fruits and vegetables?
I see your point. I don't know if you keeping all those 20 boxes of pasta that you had,
but
maybe,
see, but I'm not.
You know, that's what I'm concerned about here.
But I'm buying the pasta that has vegetables already in it. I make my own bread every Sunday. I don't buy canned vegetables. I buy the ones now that are fresh steamed. I eat very healthy. I have a little girl now that I took in because she needed a home. And she has a history of ADD in her family. She is on no medication. She gets no artificial fruits, colors, any of that stuff because I make all our stuff. So, no, you can eat very healthy using coupons. And that's the thing that people tend to think when their finances are a little lower. They buy those convenience foods that are chucked with sodium and all that other junk when they actually can use coupons for the necessary things they have to get, so it gives them more money to buy the healthier things.
Do you always shop with a list?
I never need to shop, so I never have to pay what the regular price is. So when I'm going to the store, it's always cherry picking to get what I can get for less than nothing and just keep my pantry stocked.
All right. Joy's house is Miss Coupon Diva, and she was kind enough to join us from Philadelphia with her couponing expertise. Miss Diva, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you. And they can look me up at MissCouponDiva.com.
All right. But are you going to offer a discount?
We'll talk.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And let's talk about this week's royal wedding now with Tina Brown. She is the editor of the Daily Beast and Newsweek, which have been giving extensive coverage to the royal wedding of William and Kate Middleton. And, of course, she's also author of the Diana Chronicles about Princess Diana. Tina, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here, Steve.
I don't know if you count as a royal watcher. Do you count as a royal watcher?
Well, I'm kind of an in-and-out royal watcher. You know, I did spend 2 years with Diana and interviewed about 300 people, so I feel pretty imbued with royal stuff.
And how does Kate Middleton compare to Diana, which is the question that so many people have been asking?
Well, just radically compares, actually. I mean, in every conceivable way. In fact, in some ways, you know, William chose her as being the un-Diana. Much though he loved his mother, she did provide a great deal of drama as well as love in his life. And so he was really looking for stability. So here's Kate, who is this middle-class girl who comes not from a pedigreed family as Diana did, who is very solid. She is as firm and calm and undrama-like as you could possibly imagine. And, of course, she's a woman now of nearly 30. So there's been this long trial period where he's really put it to the test of, can you stick this out? I mean, he did not want to have what happened to his father, which was a bride that hardly knew what she was getting into, and then a huge letdown as she realized how disastrous this was going to be for her.
How long have they known each other, William and Kate?
They've known each other since they were at St. Andrews University when they were students, when they were 20. You know, this is a long romance.
You know, one of the things that fascinates me about comparing these two brides, actually, is the time frame that each represents. One wedding was in 1981, 30 years ago. The other is in 2011. You have a writer in Newsweek this week talking about the way that Britain has changed in those 30 years.
Well, indeed, it's really quite dramatic when you look at it. I mean, actually, there are some things that are similar. You know, 2.5 million are out of work right now with the austerity cuts and the you know, the budget slashes and all the economic austerity that's happening in England. There were actually the same amount of people exactly out of work at the time of Charles and Diana when Mrs. Thatcher came in and began her draconian moves.
Oh, there was a big recession then as well, right?
There was a big recession then. The difference then, of course, is that they had North Sea oil to bail them out. And Mrs. Thatcher hadn't yet kind of deregulated the financial institutions, and so there was about to be a boom. That is not going to happen again. There is, you know, the North Sea oil thing has really, that's peaked. And I don't think anybody thinks that deregulated banks are going to exactly help when they've been bailed out by, you know, everybody in sight. So that's a big difference between these two eras. But there's also incredible just little details, like the fact that, you know, when Charles and Diana left for their honeymoon, they left on the royal yacht, which is now, in fact, a museum. And it had 220 seamen and 20 officers, and just them as it crisscrossed the ocean, the Mediterranean. The royal yacht is now a museum. The royal train, which they traveled on together, hardly ever leaves the siding. You know, so much of British industry now is owned by foreigners. You know, oil, as I say, is finite. Credit's finite. There's a big difference now in the Britain that you're seeing of Kate and William. And the great question is, will they be, in a way, the last royal couple, I think? That's on some people's minds, too.
What do you mean, the last royal couple? You were talking about abolishing the monarchy here?
Well, I think, you know, by the time, it really depends on the next sort of 20 years. I mean, I think that if William and Kate could come in faster, it would be way better for the monarchy. But Charles is not going to abdicate in any way. He has waited for this for so long. And he's also, I am told, really determined that Camilla will be queen. It's very interesting. The nation does not want Camilla to be queen. They don't dislike her, but they don't want her to be queen. They would like to skip to William and Kate. It's not going to happen. I mean, that requires a whole constitutional reorganization, and it would require Prince Charles to really want to make himself scarce, and he does not want to do that.
Meaning that there's going to be resistance here, but you think it's going to happen. I mean, the crown is going to be passed on here.
The crown will be passed on to Charles, and the great question is how patient the British people are going to be when he's king, and the expense and the lack of popularity of Charles are, you know, meet a head-on collision.
So Will and Kate here have got perhaps decades, certainly many years, before they're ever going to be king and queen. What are they supposed to do for that time, and what does the public expect of them?
Well, Kate primarily has to do one thing, which is breed, produce a whole bunch of heirs, an heir and a spare and maybe a couple more. So she's going to be very focused, I think, on trying to have kids and doing charity work. William, of course, is still in the Air Force. He wants to, I think, very much continue with his life in that area. And, you know, I think that they're just going to try and lead a life that's worthy, that's increasing in its charitable, presence, and show that they are people who care as much as anything else, because that's really a very important thing for the monarchy right now, to show it cares. In that sense, that is Diana's legacy.
Tina Brown of the Daily Beast and Newsweek, always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
And she's also the author of the Diana Chronicles.